Western Massachusetts has higher rates of COVID-19 than other parts of the state. However, there are continuing efforts to stop those numbers from climbing. This is And Another Thing from New England Public Media. I'm Dara Kennedy.
And I'm Maya Schwader. Free vaccine clinics are still open around Massachusetts and people are showing up. What inspired them to go now? Also, to mask or not to mask, local communities have been left to decide for themselves what COVID safety protocols they still want.
You may ask, if the rules change from town to town, is that doing more harm than good?
It's challenging for parents to understand, why does their child have to wear a mask inside the school, but then could potentially be playing in a basketball league without a mask in a different state?
That and a lot more, and another thing from New England Public Media is coming right up after the news.
This is New England Public Media News. Good evening, I'm Kari Njiri. Polls in Northampton, Massachusetts are open until 8 tonight for the city's preliminary election. Headlining the ballot is an open race for mayor after incumbent David Narkowitz decided against another term. Four candidates are vying to replace him: social worker Shana Fishel, retiree Roy Martin, City Council President Gina Louise Shara, and transportation analyst Mark Warner. The top two finishers will advance to November's general election. Some students at UMass Amherst say the administration reacted too late to find out who sent racist emails to black student organizations. The UMass Black Student Union said those groups have been getting racist emails for weeks, and the university has been slow to respond. Chancellor Kumbul Sobaswamy says the university has hired a cybersecurity firm to investigate the source of the emails. And System President Marty Meehan called the emails appalling and said those responsible will be held accountable. Vermont's Agency of Education is preparing to begin a new testing program that would allow unvaccinated students to stay in school after being exposed to someone with COVID-19. The voluntary program would use rapid COVID tests for individuals who would otherwise be required to quarantine outside of school. Education Secretary Dan French says exposed students would take the test each day for 7 days before entering their school building, and as long as the test came back negative, they'd be able to stay in school. The Connecticut Sun compete in their playoff opener tonight in Uncasville. Along with the league's best record, the Sun now also boasts the WNBA's most valuable player. Connecticut Public Radio's Frankie Graziano has more.
The WNBA has named Jonquel Jones its 2021 MVP. Jones scored 19 points per game and led the league with 11 rebounds per game. The Sun are hot. Connecticut comes into its semifinal series with Chicago, the winners of 14 straight. But are they hot enough to finally capture their first ever WNBA championship? Jonquel Jones plays in the playoffs with three-time All-Star and two-time WNBA champion DeWanna Bonner for the first time. Bonner and the Sun made the playoffs a year ago, but Jones sat out the season. She wanted to protect herself and her family from COVID-19. And two-time All-Star Alyssa Thomas is back just in time for a championship run. She missed most of the season because of an Achilles tear. The Sun play the Sky at 8 p.m. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Frankie Graziano.
And you're listening to New England Public Media.
We all probably remember that day back in the spring when masks came off. The federal government told us that we no longer needed them, and for a moment, it felt like freedom. It felt like the end of the pandemic tunnel was in sight. State by state, new rules said that if you were fully vaccinated, no masks were required anymore, and yet, in many places, mask wearing persisted.
Well, it was only the end of May when Massachusetts followed Connecticut and lifted its mask order for fully vaccinated people. But now, at least around here and in other parts of the country, masks are being required due to the surge of the Delta variant and COVID cases that began making more of an impact this summer. And the truth is, one of the hardest hit areas is right here in Western Massachusetts. With And Another Thing from New England Public Media, I'm Dara Kennedy.
And I'm Maya Schwader. The state of Massachusetts has now extended its requirement that students wear masks in school through October. But this is one of the few guidances that's come from the state level. Governor Charlie Baker has said he wants local communities to make up their own minds about whether they still want restrictions in place. And this means the COVID rules and the COVID rates vary greatly from place to place. There are still plenty of other efforts to address the pandemic in this area.
Efforts such as continuing vaccine clinics, some pop-ups in many cities and towns. Nurse Shelly Ann Thompson oversees a weekly clinic at Springfield Technical Community College.
Some weeks we do a handful, some weeks we do, you know, much more. A lot of people are coming in due to work mandating or school mandating. So, and some people just see us with the signs outside and walk in.
And there are all sorts of reasons people who initially chose not to get vaccinated changed their minds.
I want to rejoin my chorus, and you need to be vaccinated to do it. So I thought, okay, I'm scared, and, you know, every place now is kind of requiring it, so I need to just do it.
Well, my sister gave me a push. She told me that she ordered some comedy tickets, and if I didn't get vaccinated, I couldn't go. So, I got it done.
I'm looking at all the science and all of the scientists and everyone, and I'm thinking, okay, enough. This is crazy. So that's why I finally said, okay, I'm ready.
But as restrictions change in different communities, confusion continues to mount about best practices to stay safe these days. And another thing spoke to people on their lunch break this afternoon in downtown Springfield and asked their take on the varying rules.
Pedro, Springfield. Sometimes you walk into places and you kind of confused if you got to wear a mask or not. You know, they're not as hard on it as they were when COVID really hit. So it's kind of confusing when you see people who don't wear the mask, even though there's a sign. There's a lot of places not enforcing them, you know, so it's kind of confusing, you know.
John Amherst. It's getting clearer, but it is somewhat confusing about whether, because different towns have different regulations, and whether it's inside or outside, yes, I find it a bit confusing as to the different restrictions and different locations.
Chris Shewell from Springfield. I feel like there's a lot of misinformation out in the public. A lot of people are trying to do their own research. And I feel like that's cool, but there is a lot of misinformation that's out there. And then these people use that very same information to kind of like die on the hill with it. I feel like the COVID thing is real. I feel like the vaccine should be a choice, but I do believe that people should be vaccinated just to protect themselves and others.
Earlier in the show, we talked about how the governor of Massachusetts has left it up to communities to decide how to best move forward with COVID in their midst. That's fine if you mostly stay home, but can cause confusion when people need to, well, go places. This is a challenge well known to Jessica Collins. She is the executive director of the Public Health Council of Western Massachusetts.
This has been a consistent challenge throughout the COVID-19 pandemic, especially when you think about a local municipal level where you have different volunteer elected boards that are supposed to be interpreting state regulations and then setting policies for their community. So in the case of COVID, where you had different state departments setting different regulations, it is hard for lay people, if you will. Oftentimes elected officials are not experts in their field that they are supposed to be setting regulations for. It has been a challenge. Different state departments have been setting different regulations and not consistent with each other, and then playing that out at a local level. And I think that has been unfortunate.
For the average person who is trying to get their kids to school, go to work, go grocery shopping, how does this impact them as they're just trying to figure out what's still safe to do right now?
Well, I think it's very challenging. I think it's challenging for parents to understand why does their child have to wear a mask inside the school, but then could potentially be playing in a basketball league without a mask in a different state. Or there's a recommendation to wear a mask in a restaurant, and yet then their child can be sitting in other places, you know, where they cannot have a mask on. So overall, I think it has been very challenging for parents to understand what exactly are the best practices and the best advice in order to protect their families.
With all this confusion, what effect does that then have on just overall health of the community?
Well, it just leads to, you know, inconsistent prevention practices, and it makes people more vulnerable, obviously, as we've seen, to the Delta variant. And I think people all over are obviously trying to do the best for their families. But I think we've seen that there is inconsistency in different environments. And now there is, you know, it's been very politicized. So I think there's kind of strong stances, if you will, about how people are interpreting and then following through for their families. And, you know, I think it's, as you can see from the data, made our communities overall, you know, very vulnerable, continue to be very vulnerable to this particular virus.
There are health officials who are recommending taking additional precautions, such as not gathering in large groups, wearing your masks inside. These are not mandatory across the board, however. Does having these suggestions out there help, or is it creating more confusion?
Well, I think overall, what has been consistent since, you know, way back in the beginning of our time together with COVID-19 is that there are some very clear prevention practices. Wear a mask, social distance, wash your hands. And those have actually not changed. The requiring and the mandating, it's a very bold move. For some municipalities that felt like, you know what, we're going to make this mandate and we are going to figure out resources in order to enforce it, you know, hats off to them. But for other communities that, quite frankly, don't have resources to enforce, it's been a harder call to make.
Speaking of which, there have been some states that have taken a more centralized approach to COVID policies. And there are some states like Massachusetts, for instance, where it's been very decentralized, where the governor has said each community can choose for itself. Does one of these approaches better serve the public?
Well, I think we're going to learn that. We're going to look back historically and learn what did work well, what did throw us off. And I think when you're in the middle of the storm, it's hard to know that.
Jessica Collins is the executive director of the Public Health Institute of Western Massachusetts. Thank you so much for your insights.
Thank you, Brad.
Thank you for being with us. The And Another Thing conversation is focused on trying to ease some of the confusion around the COVID-19 infections in Springfield and many parts of Western Massachusetts. For a little advice, we turn again to a guest that joined us yesterday, an infectious disease expert at Bay State Health. He's Chief Academic Officer and Chief Physician Executive, Andrew Artenstein.
Dr. Artenstein says it clearly will take time to significantly raise the area's vaccination rate.
There's a whole host of different reasons why people are not vaccinated. Some of them are based on belief. Some of them are based on fear, and some of them are based on mistrust of government or mistrust of institutions. And in some cases, you know, there's histories and experiences throughout the last decades to support that. There's no one solution. Everyone has sort of their own story.
We're also hearing about breakthrough cases of COVID among people who have been vaccinated. For those of us who might not know, what does breakthrough mean?
So a breakthrough infection is when you've been fully vaccinated, but nonetheless, you get infected with the virus that causes COVID. Now, what we don't know, so breakthroughs are possible because most vaccines, including the COVID vaccines, do not produce what we call sterilizing immunity. And what that term means is if you have a vaccine that produces sterilizing immunity, then you cannot get infected once you've been vaccinated. But most vaccines don't do that. What they do is they protect against serious illness. So, for instance, the COVID vaccines are highly protective against getting seriously ill, getting hospitalized, or dying of COVID. But there have still been cases where people get infected. They're asymptomatic or mildly symptomatic after intense exposure, for instance, with a household contact. We actually don't know what the rate of those infections is, and there's one reason. We don't test everybody. We only test people who present with symptoms. What we do know, though, is the number of breakthrough infections that get sick, really sick, sick enough to either come to medical attention or to get hospitalized, are about 11 times less if you've been vaccinated than if you haven't been vaccinated. So the vaccine is highly protective. It protects against death. And the risk of the vaccine, honestly, no matter what you may hear or read, it's been studied. It's been studied in Israel. Over a million people who were vaccinated were compared with almost a million people who weren't vaccinated. And the safety risks from the vaccine were trivial.
Backing up to some basic precautions, for people who are vaccinated, how necessary is social distancing right now?
Well, I'll tell you the way I think about things, and I'm serious. This is the way I think, and this is the way I'm an infectious disease specialist. I think about this way, and I also describe it this way. Think about it like when you're, what's the best way to keep warm in the winter? It's to wear layers. You dress in layers, and on top of the layers, you put on a nice warm parka or coat. So consider the layers, things like masks and social distancing and being smart, avoiding big crowds inside. Consider the winter coat, the vaccine. It's the warmest piece of clothing you have. It's the most protective blanket you would have. But if you put on the layers as well, you're even going to be more protected. That's the way I think about this thing. Nothing in and of itself is 100%. The vaccine is the best of all those things by itself. But if you add them together, they each add additional layers of protection. Social distancing is probably, if you're in a room filled with vaccinated people, I still am wearing a mask if I'm inside, to be totally honest with you. But I feel a little bit better if I'm wearing a mask and I have to be a little closer to someone. Like I was in a memorial service over the weekend in a church in Massachusetts. People were wearing masks, but they were sitting in pews, so close together. And it was a vaccinated crowd. I feel that was low risk. But I still wear the mask. But if I can avoid a big crowd shoulder to shoulder, for instance, I wouldn't go to an Ohio State football game where there's 100,000 screaming people shoulder to shoulder simply because I think the risk is too great.
Even if that football game is outside?
It's less if it's outside. But even if it's outside, if you're that close to people, you're having 3 hours of interactions in close proximity. And I'm not picking on Ohio State. I have nothing against them.
So the same would go for mask wearing then? It's probably a good idea?
Again, I understand it's highly charged and it gets people upset. And I understand it's unpleasant. I don't like it any better than anyone else after 18 months. I want to go back to normal, but I'll also tell you that it is a very low price to pay for some less risk. I think it reduces the risk. That's clear. People can make their own decisions, but I do think it adds a free and easy, cheap layer of protection that's harmless.
Dr. Andrew Artenstein of Bay State Health, thank you so much for spending time with us, and we look forward to hearing from you again.
Thanks for having me.
Next time on And Another Thing, imagining the new normal. What could eventually be the same, and what may have changed forever as a result of COVID-19?
Relief from all the COVID talk, we shift gears and reflect on the life of a virtuoso horn player from Western New England.
And Another Thing, a production of New England Public Media.
This is And Another Thing. I'm Maya Schwader.
And I'm Dara Kennedy. You're listening to And Another Thing. We've talked a lot about COVID, and we're sure that you're overwhelmed, but we'd like to know how you feel. Call and let us know. 1-800-639-9120. You can also reach us across social at AAT on NEPM. And let us know how you're doing. Now, if you'll allow us for a moment, let's step away from coronavirus talk and find a way to relax. A new exhibit at the Springfield Museum pays tribute to a legendary musician from the South who later adopted Western Massachusetts as his home. New England Public Media's Kari and Jerry recently visited Horn Man, the life and musical legacy of Charles Neville.
Mm-hmm.
By the time he died of cancer in April 2018 at age 79, Charles Neville had traversed a global journey few of us could ever imagine. Hornman chronicles that journey in a visual and sonic exhibit, from his early days growing up in New Orleans, a paradox of a city both culturally rich and diverse, yet deeply segregated, to a decades-long international career touring with his siblings, the Neville Brothers, and to his presence on the New England music scene, mentoring aspiring musicians.
My name is Maggie Humberston, and I'm the curator of library and archives at the Wood Museum of Springfield History.
Humberston says Charles Neville's personal photographs, instruments, illustrations, and other mementos laid out through the exhibit were contributed by his wife, Kristen, who Charles first met and married in the early 1990s. Of course, music is prominently featured as well throughout the exhibit, with sound stations designed to provide visitors a soundtrack reflecting various phases of Neville's life.
We have five of these sound stations situated throughout the exhibit, pretty much one with each panel, and so that as you read the panel, you can also experience the music that Charles was listening to and that was influencing him as he was growing up. And then later in the show, some of his own music and the Neville Brothers' music.
Humberston says the exhibit also offers a candid look into the challenges Neville faced and the struggles to overcome them.
A long-standing drug addiction, heroin addiction. He tried to break that by going to rehab a number of times. Kristen has been very open about sharing that part of his life. He kept some journals in the 1980s, which he illustrated, and she shared those with us, and we've made those part of the exhibit so that you can look at some of the pages. And it's just so poignant, but there's an optimism that runs through his story.
That story includes his embrace of African and Eastern spiritual practices. Voodoo deities that permeate New Orleans culture are invoked to help overcome his 3-decades-long addiction, a habit he was first introduced to while serving in the U.S. Navy. And Kristen Neville says Tai Chi, the martial arts-based exercise for meditation and health, would become a daily practice for her husband.
It was this wonderful discovery for him to kind of, I guess, help connect his mind and body and spirit. And he'd wake up at 5 a.m. and do his stretches and do his Tai Chi and his Qigong. And so for a couple hours every morning, he would do that. And when he'd go out on the road, that was the thing he did to kind of keep him centered and grounded.
Neville's ever-present Tai Chi shoes are among the personal items in the collection. Another is a tie-dye T-shirt, which would become a fixture in his attire. Kristen Neville says it symbolized a transition in the 1960s. He'd served a 3-year jail stint at Louisiana's notorious Angola State Penitentiary for possessing 2 marijuana joints. He then went to New York City.
Listen here, baby. Stop acting so crazy. You say your mama ain't home and ain't my concern. Just come play with me and you won't get burned. I'm the only one who itch and desire. Let me stand next to your fire.
It was a huge shift in life experience from this really oppressive, dangerous situation in the prison that was reflective of slavery to the summer of love. Hippies and just being embraced by white people, having come from a very different situation in the South. And later on in like the early 80s, when the brothers formed as a band and they connected with Bill Graham, the manager, and he put them on tours with the Grateful Dead and these shows with, you know, Grateful Dead fans with lots of tie-dyes were really digging their music and just loved it, loved them.
After Charles Neville moved to Huntington, Massachusetts in the 1990s, he continued touring with his brothers and eventually his sons, Khalif and Talon, who grew up in Western Mass. a video produced and edited by Khalif Neville, featuring interviews with some of his father's musical colleagues, is also in the exhibit. Charles Neville became a presence on the local music scene as well, from mentoring young musicians at the Community Music School of Springfield to co-founding the Springfield Jazz and Roots Festival. Curator Maggie Humberston says she never got to know Neville personally, but she says she hopes visitors, be they fans or new to Neville's story, will come away with a new appreciation for the man affectionately called Horn Man.
I think for me, it was his just continual resilience, which is a word that, you know, everybody bandies about, and everybody has a certain amount of personal resilience. But this guy always rose out of it. You know, Angola didn't take him out. Drug addiction didn't take him out. Whatever he faced, he always found a way to rise above it.
Horn Man, the life and musical legacy of Charles Neville, is on exhibit at the Wood Museum of Springfield History through the end of November. For New England Public Media, I'm Kari Ngiri.
And another thing is a conversation, and we want you to be part of it. There are lots of ways to join in.
Call and leave us a message, 800-639-9120.
You can also leave comments on the And Another Thing page of NEPM.org.
You can also join the conversation across social platforms, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at AAT on NEPM.
And of course, you can email us at andanotherthing@nepm.org.
And visit our website for exclusive and photos and more write-ups at nepm.org. I'm Dara Kennedy.
I'm Maya Schwader. This has been And Another Thing. Thanks for joining us.